Tonight, a history of the Knights Templar and the legendary Holy Grail like you've never heard before. For nearly 1,000 years, the Knights Templar have been regarded to be the eternal guardians of the Holy Grail. But what the Holy Grail actually is, well, has it been accurately revealed? Stand by. You may find out in a moment with our guest Mark Pinkham right here on Coast to Coast AM. Mark Pinkham is a Templar Knight, a lecturer, a historian, an international sacred tour leader, the author of a series of books that cover many of the secrets and mysteries that have been omitted from mainstream historical texts. Most recently, Mark joined with Ian Sinclair of Clan Sinclair, the builders of Roslyn Chapel, to form the International Order of Gnostic Templars. Ian and his wife Andrea currently direct the North American branch of this order in Sedona, Arizona. Mark also leads tours to places around the world that are or have been sacred to the Knights Templar. He's back as a guest on Coast to Coast AM. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi, George. It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
Me too. I did not know the first time that you were indeed a Templar Knight. Tell me about that.
Well, it's happened rather quickly over the last 2 or 3 years since I first made the acquaintance with Ian Sinclair. I've made numerous journeys up to Scotland since then and visited Ian's preceptory, Templar preceptory, in northern Scotland called the Prince Henry St. Clair Templar Preceptory. And during that time, I've gone through a series of initiations. Actually, most recently, I became the Grand Prior of this order, of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, before I became squire and Templar Knight and went through the ranks, so to speak. And during that time period, we've also been taking a lot of other people up there for special initiation from Ian Sinclair.
Is it a secret organization, Mark?
No, it isn't at all, George. And we certainly want to keep it that way. We feel that the truth, the wisdom, the knowledge, the light should be available for everybody. And we believe that the original mystery schools offered the true wisdom without having to go through secret initiations, that the wisdom was available for everybody, but that wisdom had to become secretive simply to protect itself from fundamentalist doctrines and those that were out to destroy anything that they didn't understand.
Now, when you say you're a Templar Knight, was this like being the same kind of Templar Knight that was back hundreds and hundreds of years ago that apparently are guarding, protecting the Holy Grail and things like that? Same kind of group?
There has been a continual lineage, and that's one thing that we're finding out now, that the Templars did survive even after their mass arrest in 1307, when it appeared as though the order had been dissolved. It does appear as though that the Templars did survive. Many of them went up into Scotland, for example, and there they became part of a Freemasonic organization called the Order of Herodom. And they were part of Freemasonry for many years until mid-1800s, when a man named Alexander Duchar decided to give the Templars their own independent identity again. And then he established the Militi Templi Scotia, which is one of the Templar organizations of Scotland today. Well, when I met Ian Sinclair, he was a preceptor, initiator into the Militi Templi Scotia. But he was rather discouraged with the organization because he felt as though it should expand and become more international and invite in everybody and make the knowledge available to everybody. And so he decided to join with me to create an order that could do that.
We hear a lot, Mark, about the Templars and the Freemasons. And I get, I got to tell you, I mean, a week can't go by without getting at least one email, one phone call from someone who's trying to connect the dots between what they are, what they were, that they are indeed secret societies, that some of them may be up to no good, though a lot of Masons will call my program and say, no, this is not true. What is the relationship, and what do you think about the Freemasons organization as well?
Well, obviously, there's a strong connection between the Templars and the Freemasons. The legend is that, as I just mentioned, a lot of the Templars that survived the mass arrest in 1307 just disappeared into Freemasonic organizations, and so they essentially transferred their ancient rites and mysteries and ideologies into Freemasonry, and you can see that today. For example, they say in the 17th and 18th degree of the Scottish Rite, the Knight of East and West and the Knight of the Rose Cross, these rites are actually based on ancient ceremonies and rituals that the Templar Knights themselves observed. And so there is a continuation there. There's a continuation basically between most all the secret societies in Europe and the Templars. Most all of them have some connection to the Templars, because the Templars were the first to really bring into Europe this the path of what we call Gnosticism, the path of intuitive wisdom, the path of knowing yourself without the aid of a book or a preacher or any kind of outer tool. We believe in the Gnostic path, the knowledge is within you, and it's just a matter of going in there and finding it. And we believe that the Templars found out how to do it via the Sufis and some of the teachers and masters they met in the Holy Land. And so most of these sects of secret societies, whether it's the Rosicrucians or Freemasons or even the Illuminati, basically they were based upon creating a path of Gnosticism, of contacting that inner wisdom, that inner intuitive knowledge that's there within all of us. So that's kind of the string that binds them all together. You'll even find that Adam Weishaupt, who founded the Illuminati, he was essentially a Gnostic, and he wanted to break down all the institutions that were telling people what to believe so that they could, in a sense, find that inner wisdom, that inner knowledge, without being impeded in that process.
Mark, when I was reading your book, Guardians of the Holy Grail, it was almost like a historical nonfiction version of the Indiana Jones movies, because, I mean, it is a mystery, and it is a journey, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's pretty exciting, actually, George, because the more that you dive into the history, the more it reveals itself, and it does come out to be something like an Indiana Jones movie. For example, last time I was on, I talked about the Templars being initiated into a very, very ancient lineage in the Holy Land that went back thousands of years before they even arrived in the Holy Land, and it goes all the way back to the East. And even begins in Sri Lanka many thousands of years before they even arrive. Of course, there's loads of legends about what the Templars were doing and the treasures that they found and how they were digging around Solomon's temple for 9 years and then left with, one legend says they left with 5 crates of boxes after 9 years, and they took them up into Europe with them and then hid them from that point. Well, where did they hide them, and what was in them? These are rather intriguing questions, and I think we're starting actually to come up with some answers for them.
I want to talk with you a lot about Roslyn Chapel tonight, and also already people are calling to talk with you. We're going to wait until the third hour for that. But Mark, tell me the significance of the Holy Grail. I want your definition of the Holy Grail, and what was the original version, the text of the Holy Grail, of course, was supposed to be, I think, the cup that Jesus drank from, was it not?
That's right. That's what we normally associate with being the Holy Grail. But actually, George, if you start looking around, you'll find that there are many Holy Grails, and they've been Holy Grails in existence thousands of years before Jesus even took birth. So these aren't just associated with him. There were chalices found in Sumeria, for example, that have mystical powers associated with them. There are stones and chalices from the Far East that are thousands of years older than Christianity. So the Holy Grail legend and myth and Holy Grail manifestations existed way before Jesus. But one thing you find if you start looking around and examining these Holy Grails is that they all have one thing in common, and that's if you hold one or if you're just in proximity to it, it can begin within you a process of alchemical transformation. That's because it holds a certain energy. It's emanating a certain energy, a transformative energy, and that energy, it got that energy from some great master like Jesus who held it or wore it. For example, the relics of the Passion, the crown of thorns, the cross, the nails of the cross, all these things have been ascribed the powers of a Holy Grail. And this is because they were all in proximity to Jesus' body, which was full of that power, that alchemical power, because in our tradition, it's believed that Jesus was a great master who was full of power, Holy Spirit power, Kundalini power, whatever you want to call it. But he had that power that he could transmit his energy into a disciple and thereby begin that disciple's process of alchemical transformation. That power was given to the disciples, to the apostles on the day of Pentecost.
Well, tell me a little bit more about this transformation, though, if people were to touch some of these Holy Grails.
Well, I think you can see it today in some of the charismatic churches, even like the Pentecostal churches, where people will come up and get touched, or through chanting and opening themselves up to the Holy Spirit, they'll start speaking in tongues, they'll start thrashing around, there'll be bodily movements. And this is what happens when that power, that energy starts to grab you, starts to be kindled within you. And I've been around that kind of energy for most of my life because when I was in my early 20s, I was initiated into a sect of yoga in India that begins with the transmission of that energy from a great master. And so for years living in ashrams, I saw that around me all the time, how that energy moves through somebody and how it transforms them as it opens them up ultimately to their Gnostic wisdom. That's what characterizes a Gnostic path such as ours, is that there's a transformation that goes on. There's an awakening of that energy, because you can have glimpses of Gnosticism, but to be totally established in that state of enlightenment means to go through a full-scale transformation so that you can really hold that power and that consciousness within yourself.
Give me an example, Mark, if you can, of something miraculous or just mysterious that may have occurred either during transformations that you might have witnessed or episodes like that.
Well, George, it was quite amazing that in the old days when I was living in these ashrams, as soon as the lights went down and it was time to meditate, people would start doing these very strange things. A man next to you could immediately start standing on his head. The one to the left of you could be hopping like a frog or barking like a dog, or there could be fast, rapid breathing that goes on. People could be having visions. It runs the whole gamut as to what people could experience. And I myself went through those experiences. I had many, many visions, astral travel, I mean, you name it. It seems to, like I said, run the gamut, all kinds of experiences. And these all are brought on through the volition of that power. As it leads you on your path, you always get exactly what you need at that time. It's a fully conscious power, fully aware within you. And you can call that a power of the goddess, you can call it Shakti, you can call it Kundalini, you can call it the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. It's that spiral serpent at the base of the spine. It's the goddess energy is what it is. And this is why this is This is part of the goddess, the ancient goddess tradition. And this is one reason that we are reactivating and reviving this Gnostic Templar movement, because it's time to revive the ancient goddess tradition now. And this is a major part of this.
Is this also a higher form of consciousness?
Well, it leads to the highest form of consciousness, George, which we call Gnosis. And in Gnosis, you actually go through phases as you move through Gnosis. First, you get kind of a sense of us being one, that we're all brothers and sisters on this planet. And then you go a little bit further, and you get this sense that, all my brothers and sisters that we're one and the same, that I have become my brothers and sisters. We're all one spirit. We're all one soul. I have become everyone. And then you get this feeling that not only am I everyone, but I created this universe. I created everybody out of my own beingness. And so this wisdom, this knowledge kind of naturally unfolds on its own until you know proof positive conclusively who and what you are and what the universe is all about, why it was created, why we're here. All these answers are within. And I know everyone has heard that before, but not everyone has had the experience of it. And that's what we want to give people in our organization.
Tell me a little bit about why the Holy Grail, albeit many grails, why does there seem to be so much interest in it, Mark?
Because I think that there's an inner desire we all have to become immortal, to become enlightened, and to see the Christ, or to see God within the soul spirit of all of us. There is that drive to know these things, and I think that we want to know that there really is a spiritual history to this world, that it isn't just a mundane history that's built upon power and money, that there really was a history that was controlled and driven by lineages of spiritual teachers and spiritual masters, and we can still achieve that today. There's still that hope of being able to achieve these high states of consciousness, to get out of this box, to get out of this limited reality that we find ourselves in, to achieve true eternal peace and joy. And so we're driven by these desires, and the Holy Grail, the path of the Holy Grail, gives us a path through which we can do that.
Do you think we have forgotten our abilities to do this?
Yes, actually, I think we have. But the thing of it is that there's always been teachers to show us the way, just as Jesus was one of them. But so was Buddha, and so were the great mystics of the Far East. A lot of those teachers haven't been available for some time. As I said, their secret mysteries and their secret knowledge had to kind of go underground for protection, but now they're available again. Now they're pointing the path and showing, this is how you can do it. This is the way. This is the way to eternal peace and joy and happiness. And it's been, and they've been coming to the U.S. for quite a while now. I would say for the last 30, 40 years, they've been making themselves available from India, from Peru, from Egypt, from all over the world. They're coming out and saying, okay, now is the time. And so in a sense, you know, it is the time of the Holy Grail. It's the time of the masters that can show us the path of the Holy Grail, which leads to eternal life. So, yes, the Holy Grail is a symbol for this time that we're living in now.
You know, the practice of your organization, the Gnostic group that you have, also performs and practices martial arts, Tai Chi, areas like that. Why is that?
Well, what we're trying to do, George, is to make each person what we call a Gnostic warrior. And a Gnostic warrior isn't necessarily like a physical warrior that walks around with a lot of weapons and swords and spears and daggers and so forth. A Gnostic warrior is one that has the tools that can meet every challenge in his life and without any fear. and martial arts and many other things that we'll teach within the order are going to help them to live without that fear. And if you can live without that fear, you can live in spontaneity, and you can move towards that expanded consciousness.
Well, that's fascinating. We'll be back with you in a moment. Just when you think you've heard them all, an inebriated Belgian woman died in a freak accident when she ended up beneath a heavy gravestone at a cemetery. The 33-year-old was on her way home from a bar in the Belgian town of Pouilly in the early hours when she took a shortcut through the cemetery. Mother Nature called, and she was doing whatever she was doing, lost her balance, grabbed one of the headstones. It gave way, landed on top of her. She suffocated to death and was crushed. Now, that is a weird story. Hey, we're still giving you that free CD, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. It's called Perfect Possession. It's available with the After Dark newsletter when you subscribe or renew. So call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505 online. CoastToCoastAM.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Mark Pinkham, our guest. Mark, tell me a little bit about Roslyn Chapel again. Let's go back. How was it established? What was its purpose?
Well, that's one of the big questions today, George, what exactly its purpose was. We know that it was a mausoleum for Sinclairs, and it's believed to be 20 Sinclairs entombed in Roslyn Chapel in full knighted armor. However, there is an interesting legend about Roslyn that says that after the Templars were in the Holy Land for 9 years digging around Solomon's temple, they left the Holy Land, and they left with five caskets or five big boxes and made their way up into Europe. Ultimately, they ended up in Scotland, in Kilwinning, which is Mother Grand Lodge of Scottish Freemasonry, and there the boxes sat for a number of years until they were taken to Roslyn Castle, where the Sinclairs were living at that time. And then there was a big fire in Roslyn Castle. Those big boxes, however, were taken out just in time, saved, and just right after that, the beginning of the building of Roslyn Chapel happened. So it's believed that one of the main reasons Roslyn Chapel was built was to house those five boxes. So we know it's a mausoleum, and we know that it holds a lot of sacred relics, sacred treasures, everything from the head of John the Baptist, the Ark of the Covenant, to the Cup of Christ has been said to exist there in the crypt underneath Roslyn Chapel. And you can get a lot of things in there, George, because if you stand in Roslyn Chapel today and you look up at the roof, it's 44 feet above you. Well, the Roslyn Chapel goes down just as far below. It goes down 44 feet, and that's about four stories of space that you can essentially put treasures and scrolls. So there's essentially could be a lot of things there, and actually ground scans have revealed that there is a lot of things down there.
Well, why can't they get down there to look, Mark?
Well, that's the difficulty, is because getting permission to take up the tiles of the floor is what's really the problem. The Erskines, and not the Sinclair clan, are the ones that are in charge of Roslyn Chapel today, and they're not particularly interested in going underneath and getting what's in the crypt, mainly because they don't have that much invested in it. It's really the Sinclair history. It's not theirs. The Sinclairs lost the rights to Roslyn Chapel about five generations back. And
well, who owns it then? This other family?
Well, it's the Erskine clan. Peter Sinclair Erskine, he's the Earl of Roslyn today. And
what do you think it's worth if somebody were to make them an offer and just say, hey, we want to buy this place?
It's worth a ton today, George. I was just talking to Niven Sinclair. I was in the UK for much of the summer, and he told me, he said, boy, if I could have just bought the place a few years back, I could have got it for a drop in the bucket, but now it's going to cost millions. The reason being because of the popularity of certain Freemasonry books like the Hiram Key, and most recently, of course, it's the Da Vinci Code. So everyone's flocking there, and of course, they're paying a top dollar to see it. And you might have heard that they filmed the Da Vinci Code and rented the place for a few days and paid £100,000, about almost $200,000 for 3 days of rent. And so it's obviously worth a lot of money right now.
So, but you're saying the Ark of the Covenant, the head of John the Baptist, maybe the Holy Grail, that those are just among the items that could be buried down there or in that chamber?
That's right. That's right. There's scrolls. It's believed there were scrolls. In fact, when they were bringing those five boxes out of the Holy Land, as they were bringing them through Europe, they stopped in Omer, which is the hometown of Geoffrey Omer. He was one of the original nine knights, and Lambert Omer. He was a priest in that town. He actually copied over one of those scrolls. And you can see that copy in one of the museums in Ghent, Belgium today. It's called the Heavenly Jerusalem, and it has all kinds of Masonic symbolism, as well as Johannite symbolism. Johannite heresy basically says that there was a tradition that emanated or descended from John the Baptist and John the Apostle, and that John the Apostle was one, if not the true successor to Jesus. So you see this symbology all throughout this copy. Well, the writers of the Hiram Key believe that some of the scrolls were Essene scrolls that the Templars took out of the Holy Land, and they did pick a lot of Masonic rites that eventually became part of Freemasonry today.
Or who knows what other things are in those scrolls, because as we well know, the Essenes wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. What if this is just a continuation of those scrolls?
That could be absolutely right. Some people think it's the scrolls that confirm the marriage between Jesus and Mary. Some of the scrolls confirm the Holy Grail lineage, the Johannite lineage the Templars were initiated into, that emanated from John the Baptist and John the Apostle. So it's potential that it could be all kinds of scrolls. It's actually conclusive that there was a black Madonna, or is a black Madonna down there, because the original altar had a big black Madonna in it. You see, Roslyn Chapel was built to, one reason it was built is to be a monument to the goddess and the goddess tradition. And Gnosticism comes out of the goddess tradition, which is one reason that our order is very connected to Roslyn Chapel and the Sinclairs. The Sinclairs, right from the beginning, have been the preservers of the Gnostic tradition.
But I'll tell you what I don't understand, though, Mark. If I owned a place like this family owns Roslyn Chapel, and if I knew that there was a possible chamber underneath that would be easy to have some access to, and you could get in there with the right kind of equipment that could have some of the greatest mysteries of mankind, I'd be down there in a heartbeat. I don't understand why they're holding back. There's got to be another reason here.
Well, you could be absolutely right. The Sinclairs I've talked to think that it's just not in the interest of Peter Sinclair Erskine to do it. However, he could be being influenced by some silent partners, or perhaps the church itself, knowing that what is down there could have a very detrimental effect on them. Certainly.
So I was gonna say, what do you think the ramifications are if the Ark of the Covenant is there, the head of John the Baptist, some of the Essene scrolls? Well, I mean, what's the downside then?
Well, it has the effect of blowing the roof off the Catholic Church, but we think that that's inevitable anyway. We believe, according to the prophecy
of Malachi.
Well,
how would it do that, though? How would it blow the lid off the Catholic Church?
Well, first of all, if there's Johannite scrolls, that confirmed the Johannine lineage, it would say, one, that John the Apostle and not St. Peter was the true successor of Jesus. And second, it would say that Jesus is part of a very long lineage of masters who were all great enlightened beings. He wasn't the one only Son of God, but he was one of many. And so think about the effect that that would have on Christian ideology.
Well, maybe they just have to adjust and change it a little bit.
Well, that's it. We're hoping there's not going to be a huge mass hysteria when this information comes out, which we think it will eventually, which is why one reason that we are forming the International Order of Gnostic Templars, because we want to show people that Jesus was a great master, no question, and he can be a savior if you choose him as such. But he was not the only one and only. He was part of a very long lineage of masters that goes all the way back to Sri Lanka, and it's this lineage that unites East and West together. And that's what we believe was the original goal of the Templars, was to unite East and West forms of spirituality, and they weren't able to complete that goal. So one reason we have formed is to complete that goal of the Templars.
I guess you can't force someone, if this is private property, you can't force them to open up these chambers, can you?
No, absolutely not. And there's also, you have to get permission from Historical Scotland, who are in control of all these ancient monuments, and that's extremely difficult as well. But it wasn't that long ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that panel was taken up off the floor, and there was an excavation that occurred under the guidance of Andrew Sinclair, and they dug down through a lot of sand. Actually, what they found is that the crypt is backfilled by hundreds of tons of sand. It looks as though this could be for the purpose of preserving whatever down there. But so Andrew and whoever was involved with that excavation, they found some things. They found a wooden chalice, for example, which actually would have been closer to the vessel that Jesus would have had at the Last Supper than a lot of them Holy Grails that are out there today. But they also found apparently a couple skulls, human skulls, and we know that the Templars were very much involved with using skulls in their worship. And these skulls had trepanation holes both sides of the head, where if humans had horns, this is where they would be.
Horns? So, you mean like devilish horns?
Well, yeah. But what's interesting is that if you go into Roslyn Chapel today, it's full of heads of the Green Man, and the Green Man is the Lord of Nature, who's sometimes depicted as a horned deity or a horned god. So perhaps these human skulls were actually drilled to represent this Green Man, this horned god, which does appear to be a deity, have been a deity of the Templars, because that's actually a natural deity of Gnostics, is to open their eyes to nature, to see God everywhere, to see the deity of nature, who is the Green Man, who is the original son of the goddess, you see.
What if these are the skulls of the fallen angels that were depicted in the Bible, in Genesis, you know, and maybe they were, you know, like Satan, for example, Luciferians?
Well, that's that whole ideology is actually one that was built up by through the patriarchal fundamentalist traditions. It's not something that you find in the ancient goddess tradition. In that tradition, you find Gnostics opening their eyes to nature and seeing the spirit of nature, which they referred to as the son of the goddess. He was Dionysus. He was Murigian. He was Osiris, and he was the deity that they went out and danced with in the wilderness, in the woods. And this is apparently what was happening around Roslyn Chapel, because gypsies used to come there all the time. The gypsies were actually protected by the Sinclairs, and they would camp out right around Roslyn Chapel, and they would be convorting with the Green Man all summer as they were doing this. And so their worship seems to have rubbed off a bit on the Sinclairs, but the Sinclairs were already Gnostics themselves, so they were very familiar with the Green Man. But this is an experience that you can have commonly in the goddess tradition, but What's happened over time is that leaders of the patriarchal tradition have decided that this spirit of nature, lord of nature, this son of the goddess, is the devil himself. But they're normally, what you find is they're normally not people that have had direct experience of this being. And 9 times out of 10, they are relying on what others have told them about this being. Right?
Well, I got to tell you, though, Mark, if they've got horned skulls down there of half human or half whatever, I mean, that is an incredible find, both for religion and for science.
Right. Well, I didn't say necessarily that they had horns, George. I said that they had trepanation horns. That means there was holes drilled where horns would have been if we did have horns, you see.
Yeah, but I mean, what if they were trying to, hide those horns that were there or do whatever they had to do? Isn't it weird to drill in that spot?
Yes and no. If you travel around the world and go into different museums, for example, in Egypt and Peru, you can see a lot of skulls that have trepanation holes in them. And it's more common to find the holes around the third eye, but you can find them in other parts of the head. And these holes were drilled so that whoever owned that skull could have more of a Gnostic vision. They could activate certain psychic centers within the brain so that they could establish themselves in Gnostic consciousness. So it's actually pretty common around the world.
Do any countries, any major groups seem to have any interest at all in what could be in that crypt?
Oh, I think that everybody does. I think everyone's waiting around to see what's going to be there. Certainly, the Scottish people have a lot of vested interest. They believe that some of the Scottish crown jewels are in there. The Holy Rood, which is a piece of the original cross that was brought to Scotland during the time of Malcolm Canmore, that could be there. Certainly, those that are involved with the Essene movement, those that are interested in the idea of Jesus and Mary having married and creating a lineage between them. I think that absolutely is very many. Certainly the Johannite tradition today, there is a Johannite church that says it's descended from John the Apostle. And there could be scrolls that do say, that do talk about that lineage, that it came from John the Baptist, John the Apostle, and down a lineage of John's, and then it was inherited by the Templars and then taken into Europe with them.
Is this a mystical place, Mark? I mean, when you're in there, do you feel strange or any kind of powers like that?
Well, it depends when you go, I think. If you're going in the middle of the day and in the middle of summer, you're not as liable to experience as much as if you went in the middle of winter when not many people are there. However, there have been people that have gone in there that are very mystically oriented. For example, there was someone that was actually the archivist for the Dalai Lama. He went in there, he visited Roslyn Chapel, and he came out and he says, "Wow, this is an amazing place. I've had a truly magnificent spiritual experience here." And soon after that, there was a feng shui master that went in there and did all kinds of measurements. And he said, "This is Roslyn's one of the most powerful sites he's ever visited. He's ever done any measurements on in the whole entire world, and he sees it as being the a great center of peace for the new era." So, yes, to answer your question, there is a lot of power, a lot of energy there, and that was the idea behind making it. It's kind of a small Gothic cathedral, and my belief, after being in a lot of Gothic cathedrals, is that they were all designed to generate this power of the Holy Spirit, this alchemical power of the Holy Grail, that when you are surrounded by that power, that the process of alchemical transformation goes on naturally within you. And the Sinclairs refer to Roslyn Chapel as the Holy Grail of their family, of their clan.
Your website, of course, GnosticTemplars.org. The book, Guardians of the Holy Grail, where can people obtain that, Mark?
Certainly Amazon.com. They can order it, or they can order it through us, 800-231-9811. They can order it. Just give us a call, or you can Order it online. Go to going to our website, GnosticTemples.org.
All right, Mark, when we come back next hour, let's talk a little bit about alchemy. What were they really trying to concoct anyway? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.